one of the most ten most influential rabbis in America. Sounds like the Swedish Chef.
No, it's
what is that?
It's cantor Ari Schwartz with a Hebrew version of Hallelujah.
He started off too high. He's got nowhere to go. He's going to...
No, that's as high as they
go. He's going to tap out at the high end. Rabbi Steve Leder, twice named, I don't know, by Newsweek magazine. Oh, I just realized we got a typo in our bio there. Anyway, Steve Leder is the senior rabbi of Wilshire Boulevard Temple in L.A., serving over 2,400 families at three campuses. Sounds like a fast food joint, doesn't it? He's the author of such critically acclaimed books as The Extraordinary Nature of Ordinary Things, an Amazon number one bestseller, and More Money Than God, Living a Rich Life Without Losing Your Soul. Ooh, I like that. Described as a gift by Forbes. Huh. This is some good stuff. I wonder how much he has to pay to get this kind of press. Rabbi Leder's newest book, More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. That was the last time he was on the show. We talked to him about this book. He's working on another one. He's actually stolen my idea. You know who else stole my idea? What's his name? Morgan Freeman.
Really?
He's doing that show about different God stuff in different communities.
Yeah.
I pitched that to the same network that's airing it. And I think they liked the idea, but they decided that they wanted a guy with freckles.
Well, you haven't got the voice for it.
Yeah.
I don't. Rabbi Steve Leder, the man I know as the rabbi with the most circumcision jokes you've ever heard in your life.
Who gave you that tip, Drew?
You are hilarious. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm very happy to be with you today. It's always a high point of my day when I get to talk with you.
Oh, stop it. What?
It's true.
Now, listen, when a rabbi takes a sabbatical, I mean, there's nothing more Jewish than the word sabbatical. I mean, you guys already have enough stinking holidays. Why do you need a sabbatical?
Well, look, to give you a serious answer, there are four parts to my job, and I can do any two of those four parts really well at the same time, but the other two suffer.
Okay.
So those four parts are, number one, taking care of my members of my congregants. You know, 10,000 people who have weddings, funerals, bar bat mitzvahs, baby namings, brises, personal and difficult issues. So there's all of the what I call hatch matching and dispatching for all of those 10,000 people.
Hatch matching and dispatching. That's good. All right. Number two,
taking care of the staff. Right, we have a staff, full-time staff of over 400 people who also have lives and problems and need access and ideas and supervision and encouragement. So that's the second piece, right? The third piece is the fundraising, because to keep an institution the size of Wilshire Boulevard Temple going, you have to feed it. Mm-hmm. And that is a constant and difficult effort of telling the story, of reaching out, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So that's the fundraising part.
You know, you could slow that third part down if you just hit up Kenny Hertz once in a while.
Well, yeah. You know, Kenny's a generous guy, but, you know, we need hundreds of people to make things work.
All right.
And the fourth leg of that stool is writing, thinking, preaching, teaching. The meaning of the word rabbi is teacher. And so when I am deluged with the quotidian responsibilities of running such a large institution and taking care of so many people, that's the one that suffers. It's the writing and the thinking and the teaching that suffers. And the only way to do that in a substantive way, in a real way, in a meaningful way, is to unplug from those other three responsibilities. So every other year, I take 3 months off. I don't go to the office. I lock myself somewhere, you know, I'm sort of a cave dweller during that period.
Yeah.
And I write.
And that's what you're doing right now.
That's correct.
Cave dwelling?
Exactly right.
He's cave dwelling. Oh. Your people know about that, eh?
I was going to say.
Yeah.
I want to.
You know, the Nazarites, right? They dwelled in the cave and didn't shave and refrain from alcohol, and you know, they were ascetics, but not permanently. They took periods of life when they knew they needed to detach, and I just can't get any creative work done when I'm putting out fires all day long.
Yeah, I want to introduce you to my buddy here. What's your name again? Mubeen Sheikh is his name. Mubeen, he is an ex-Muslim extremist turned undercover intelligence operative. He's the author of Undercover Jihadi. He's the guy we go to when things blow up. And Mubeen, this is Rabbi Steve Leader.
Rabbi, shalom aleichem, ma shalomcha.
Aleichem salam. I'm really privileged to meet you. You're on the side of the good guys. That makes me very happy.
Excellent.
Wait, don't you? I thought you guys didn't agree on stuff.
Imagine that.
We agree on that. We agree on that.
When was the last time, Rabbi Steve Leader, that you had a face-to-face, toe-to-toe, mano-a-mano, MMA-type conversation with a Muslim?
You know, I do it more frequently than you might imagine. The Islamic Center of Southern California is about a mile away from my downtown office, and we have a scholar that comes and teaches our clergy every Thursday morning for an hour. And we rotate in various scholars, but one of them is Jihad Turk, who is the head of the liberal Muslim seminary in Southern California. So Jihad is a regular teacher of ours, and he and I would say we have him every 4 to 6 weeks.
I'm sorry, his name is Jihad
Drew is freaking out right now, right? He just had a convulsion.
What?
That's his real name, yeah, Jihad. It's a proper first name. I guess that's what happens when you're born before 9/11.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Anyway, he's a fantastic guy. Yes. I spend a fair amount of time with him. And I was most recently, sadly, participated in a news conference at the Islamic Center after the shootings in New Zealand.
Oh, right. You know, I love the way they handle that down there.
I'm in pretty frequent contact. And, you know, the Jews and Muslims have a tremendous amount in common. What we both, including a common enemy, which is extremism and fanaticism.
Well, I thought you were going to say evangelicals.
Those two, but that's between us, Rabbi.
Yeah, that's right. Well, today's show has this theme that is based on a premise of a song written by American singer-songwriter David Wilcox. He's written many soul-penetrating songs. We just spoke with David. He just performed that song through Skype. There was some delay, but it still came across very powerful. The song is called Three Brothers, and it's the story of three brothers who each feel that they are the brother that deserves to inherit all of their father's estate. And as the will is read, they discover that each of their wishes came true. Each brother did inherit all of their father's estate. Now, that math doesn't really make sense, but this song is an illustration of the world's three largest monotheistic religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, that happen to all come from the same piece of land that's been fought over for centuries, Jerusalem. But the most powerful narrative in the song is the impact all of this fighting between the brothers has had on their sister, and the sister's name is Faith. I thought it was powerful enough to get Rabbi Steve Leader on and Mubeen Sheikh, and then in just a little bit, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, the West's most influential Islamic scholar. Have you ever hung out with, or do you know who that is, Steve?
I don't, no, never met him.
That would be a good combo platter. You and him, heart attack, that'd be good.
Yeah.
Let's make that happen.
He's in Orange County, I think.
Shut up.
Yeah.
He's not far away.
Yeah, he's part of Zaytuna Institute. Zay Tuna Institute.
Yeah.
That sounds a bit fishy.
Why don't you moderate? Why don't you come down and moderate, and we'll do a program?
Well, I'd love to. I would love to do that.
Okay.
All right, so listen, I got you on, Steve, because, you know, many people know me as, I'm the hospital chaplain that doesn't have a place to worship. I don't go anywhere. Tony Campolo is this big Jesus guy who we're going to have on the show next week again. Along with Philip Yancey. Tony got up my nose one day and said, all right, what are you? Describe yourself. What do you believe? And so this is what I came up with. I'm a red-letter agnostic theist. Red letters. That's the stuff in the motel Bibles where you know, every time Jesus talked, it was written in red. It's good stuff, man. Really good stuff. Whether there was a real Jesus or not.
Of course there was.
Who would you Go stop on. It? Whether the all factual and blah, blah, blah. I don't care. Like, that stuff is amazing. Red letter agnostic. Yes. I don't friggin' know. And those that are certain that there is a God and those that are certain that there is no God, I don't understand those two parties. And theist.
You know how I've always dealt with that, Drew, is I tell people I'm an as-if person. I don't...
That sounds very Muslim.
Well, let me explain the context. There are all these different myths. And remember that a myth is not a lie. A myth, classically, is a way of describing a truth.
Ooh.
Not facts, but truths. Okay? So, you know, for example, my five-year-old figured this out when I was reading the story of Noah and the Ark, and she looked at me and she said, Daddy, Noah didn't really get all those animals on a boat. And that's when she discovered the difference between a fact and a truth, between a fact and a myth. I said, no, Hannah, he didn't. But it is true that we're responsible for all the creatures on this planet. And she got it at 5 years old. So let's not make this mistake that a myth means something isn't true.
Yeah.
It just means it isn't factual. So in my view, the way I deal with this question is I tell people, live as if. I don't really care whether you believe there's a God who watches or whether or not you believe there's some heavenly court before which you will stand someday when you die. I believe in living as if there is accountability, as if there is a moral exemplar in that we call God. And I believe in the power of living as if. And that to me is a way around the semantics of whether this God exists, this Jesus existed, this Moses, Abraham existed. Frankly, to me, it's not relevant. What's relevant is, can you live as if?
See, this is why I try not to get too many smart guys on my show, because it just hurts. There's so much good stuff and hard work in processing this stuff. And I'm looking at my intern hoping she's writing down some of these quotes. Like, this guy's a quote machine. Get ready with your little texting machine.
It liberates you, Drew, from having to define, from having to answer Tony's question, right? It liberates you from that.
Yeah.
You say, let me tell you. I can't tell you exactly what I am, but I can tell you exactly how I choose to live.
Okay, so then how do you sell Judaism? Like, let's say you and I are on a long flight to Australia. Fight was probably more accurately described. And we get stuck beside each other.
Yeah.
And you want a nice quiet flight and maybe want to have a sleep, and I'm Chatty Cathy. Yeah. You know, I'm that guy.
Yeah.
And
the first thing I do is lie to you about my profession.
Yes, you don't tell any. I did the same thing. When I used to be a pastor, I would never tell anybody in the flight. No way.
No.
So,
anyway,
but how would you? Yeah, how would you convince me? How would you sell me? I was going to say to get circumcised, but that, you know, it's kind of a moot point there. Like, how would you get me into the tribe? I know it's not your thing, right? Jews aren't evangelicals. You're not there to irritate us like Kirk Cameron. But what do you do?
I don't think I would pitch you. I think I would try to understand what's meaningful to you about your faith, and then talk with you about the ways in which those things that are meaningful to you also exist in my faith, and how great it is that you have your path and I have mine, but they both lead to this meaningful existence. Because the way I sometimes explain this is, I love my wife. By the way, you don't know this about me, Drew, but my wife and I got engaged on our second date.
What?
We got engaged on our second date. I fell in love with her the minute she walked in the room. And she's my wife. I love her. I love her with all my heart and soul. But that doesn't mean other men don't love their wives equally. It doesn't mean my wife is the best wife, the only wife. She's my wife. So I say Judaism is my love. It touches my heart and my soul for many reasons, not the least of which is the environment into which I was born, the parents to whom I was born, the world and country into which I was born. So it's my love. It's my affection. It makes my heart sing. I don't need for it to make your heart sing. I need your heart to sing for something. And so I'm not running around trying to convince people I'm right. There's more than one right.
How does that go over with the serious Jews?
They come from a legal system that made it very difficult to convert, extremely difficult. They were xenophobic, rightfully so, because of the Roman anti-Semitism. But the Talmudic laws that managed most of their lives, even to today, were very xenophobic, very frightened of the outside. You know, this is part of, you know, we were joking about circumcision, but this is part of the reason that important commandment has been held up. It was really a way not only of bringing babies in, but of keeping adult males out. So, you know, they're not that interested in persuading you of anything. They're more interested in being left alone to practice their faith in peace. And that's been the difficulty. But they're, by the way, much more interested in being aggressive with me than with you.
Yeah. Okay, let's say it's not your agenda. Let's say it's mine. We're still on that stinking plane to Australia.
Okay. And you want to know why? Why should I?
No, I say to you, you know, I've been thinking about jumping ship here and joining your tribe. What do I have to do?
Well, depending upon where you live, I would definitely get you the right information. But almost every community in the United States of size, in terms of Jewish population, has a conversion, a community-led pathway to conversion. In Los Angeles, there are half a dozen different ways to go about it. Most of them are 18-week introduction Judaism courses with a sponsoring rabbi, and then a period of study for 6 to 12 months after that with the rabbi. And then you sit for a kind of informal conversation with a group of three rabbis who sign off on you, and then there's some other rituals involved, including what we call mikveh, which is immersion in water. Baptism came from the Jews. And, you know, many religious traditions use water to indicate a change of status. You go in as one thing, you come out as something else. I would set you on the path. And we are a very welcoming, embracing people. We in our congregation have 30, 40, 50 converts a year. I mean, it's something we really open our arms wide to. And it's particularly important, in my opinion, because of the high percentage of Jews falling in love with non-Jews, and vice versa, given how porous the boundaries of ethnicity and religion are in America.
Okay, so as someone who came out of the Jesus scene, I don't know if I'm out of it. Oh, I'm certainly out of the Jesus scene. But anyway, my point is, I'm listening to, and I'm thinking about Mubin, and we're going to talk to Sheikh Hamza Yusuf in just a little bit. Both your tribes seem like there's a lot of hoops to jump through in order to be part of the club. Where the Jesus people, you know, would say, hey, you know what, just go into a quiet place and say, hey, look, I know I'm human, and I know I'm not perfect. And God, if you're real, I'm hoping you hear me, and I get the Jesus stuff and what he taught and said, and that's your best example of how, and so I'm going to try to do that, and please help me. And that should be the end of the story there.
Well, Drew, that you've just articulated why there are 1 billion Christians in the world and 13 million Jews, right? Because to become a Jew, the critique of Judaism historically has been, since the beginning, that it is a religion of deed, not creed.
Right.
That we have all of these prescribed behaviors that we need to engage in, and in order to understand how to live our lives and our priorities, et cetera, et cetera. And that belief comes as a result of those behaviors and not the other way around. Christianity and Islam, as I understand it, is much more about creed than deed. There are very few prescribed behaviors, and a lot of focus on faith in your heart. So Judaism is constructed in just the opposite way. You behave in these multiplicity of ways. You behave certain ways on the Sabbath. You behave certain ways when you eat, when you wash, when you parent, when you're in business. You have all these, they're called mitzvot, commandments. And out of that behavior grows a kind of depth of spirituality and faith. The others are constructed in the opposite way. You embrace the faith and then lead into some behaviors. But Judaism is a religion of deed, much more so than creed.
Right, right.
It goes back to that living as if. I can't argue with what you're saying. It is a longer and arguably more difficult path. But it is the essence of Judaism, and it is the difference.
Yeah.
And I'm comfortable being different than Christianity and Islam. I don't think it's a competition for bodies.
Yeah. You know, I have said this numerous times, and I think I want to keep standing by it, so let me roll with it here. That now makes a lot more sense why Jesus infuriated the religious leaders of the day to the point where they wanted to kill him. Because he...
Well, I think it was... Let me correct you from my perspective. I really don't think it was Jesus. I believe Jesus was a rabbi teaching Judaism. And I believe Jesus believed he was a rabbi teaching Judaism.
Okay.
However, Paul is a different story.
Ooh, right? Mubin just went, oh, yeah, Paul. Yeah, that guy.
So Paul makes the decision to remove some of these deeds, some of these required behaviors to being Jews, including, by the way, Judaism, including during the time of Jesus, said that to be saved, in other words, to have a place in the world to come, if you were an adult male, you had to be circumcised. Paul eliminates that. I once asked a guy named Josh Garraway, who's the leading scholar in the intertestamental period here in Los Angeles, this period where Jesus and Pauline Christianity begins to evolve and Judaism begins to evolve in a new way because of the Romans destroying the temple. I once asked him, if the rabbis of the day, when Paul decided no longer to require circumcision to be saved, if the rabbis of the day had been able to accept that change, would there be a billion Christians or a billion Jews in the world today? And he said there would be a billion Jews in the world today. So it's really Paul who begins to change the fundamental requirements of what it means to be a Jew, and thereby leads, you know, that thereby leads to an explosion of Christianity. The other thing I would say is when Constantine decides in the 4th century that Christianity will be the official religion of the Roman Empire and not Judaism, it was the beginning of, you know, a century and a half of church-sponsored anti-Semitism in Europe, which we all know resulted and continues to result in horrific suffering for many.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking through the Jesus stuff here, and, you know, when Jesus raised the bar and said, you've heard it said that it's written, if any man looks on a, you know, any man has an affair with another woman, that's adultery. And so I'm gonna lift the bar. I'm going to say, if you even think about doing it, that's not cool. And so I wonder if the teaching of Jesus lifted the bar so high that humanity finally had to say, you know what? We can't do this. And God goes, you're right, but I love you anyway. So surrender yourselves already and stop with the rules and the regulations and the letter of the law stuff. What do you think?
I think that, I don't know, obviously. None of us were there. But I think that when you lessen the moral demands and quotidian behaviors required of people, you broaden the base. I mean, it's just that simple.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a tendency that Judaism has, I won't say refused, because, you know, we have denominations in Judaism, and I don't live the life of an Orthodox Jew. I mean, there are, I'm going to put it in a funny way, there are a lot of Amish Jews in the world, and I'm not one of them. So there's a reason that the liberal Jewish movements, I'm not speaking politically, I'm speaking religiously, that the liberal Jewish movements are larger than the Orthodox Jewish movements. It's a less restrictive life. So I just think when you lower the bar, you broaden the base.
Okay, now, but that brings me to that brings me to the, I was laying in bed the other night thinking, oh, I got Steve on the show, I better lift my game. And then I fell asleep and forgot about it until right now. But I was thinking, how come you guys get to do stuff and live a certain way and it's okay because it's like cultural Judaism. But when a Christian, you know, acts inappropriately, there's a great pronouncement of judgment on them. Oh, you're not supposed to do that. I thought you were a Christian. But when somebody Jewish does X, Y, and Z, I'm not going to list them, but you know what I mean. Like, I'm thinking of especially the Hollywood scene, you know, some of the folks I've hung out with down there. And, you know, there's no great moral high ground with the Jewish folks that I know down there. And then I go, what? And then I'm trying to think of their answer. And they go, well, I'm not really Jewish. I'm Jewish.
Yeah. No, I'm not religious. Right. Yeah. I'm Jewish, but I'm not religious.
Yeah.
So let's not blame Judaism for the behavior of some Jews. Let's start with that.
Yeah. And that's across the board with all religions.
That cuts all the way across.
Yeah.
Okay. And these, in most cases, I know exactly the kind of people you're talking about. I'm going to get into a deeper point here. First of all, they probably had terrible, horrible experiences as children in their synagogues or with their rabbis. They've only been presented, many of them, with the Orthodox notion of what it means to be a Jew, and therefore they're rejecting it whole cloth. I think that's a part of it too. But now this might blow your mind, but part of the reason I think so many Jews say I'm Jewish but I'm not religious is because evangelicals in America have so dominated the cultural psyche of what it means to be a religious person in America.
No.
That Jews, I'll tell you why, Drew. Honestly, this is why I think Jews are uncomfortable talking about God in English. Because when they do, they feel like they sound like evangelical Christians. When I point out to Jews, you know, I said this once in a sermon. I said, what would happen, it was a big sermon too, you know, 2,000 people there. I said, what would you think if I got up and began my sermon this morning with brothers and sisters, let us pray? You'd think I'd lost my mind. Has the rabbi become Christian? And then I said in Hebrew, Rabotai Nevareh, which is how we begin the prayer after we eat. And I said to them, and they were all familiar with it. I said, do you know what those words mean? Rabotai Nevareh. They mean, brothers and sisters, let us pray. That came from us. But when we speak those words in English now, we feel like we sound like the other, and it makes us very uncomfortable. But it's ours, and we should own it. It's our language. It's Jewish language.
So interesting.
And you know, don't allow others to monopolize God talk in English in America, because then you will live a godless life.
Man, that's so interesting. What I meant was,
I think it's a psycholinguistic. I think what Jews have in America is a psycholinguistic objection to God, not an actual objection.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's a psycholinguistic problem that they sound like evangelical Christians when they use those words.
Isn't that so interesting to me that the litmus test for whether you're a religious knob is evangelicalism. It's just so interesting. And to my point, again, let me say this to you. Steve, sorry, Rabbi Leader. When the evangelical, like, okay, let's pick the one everyone knows, Kirk Cameron. So if Kirk Cameron was, someone took a picture of him and he was hammered at a party, just a house party or whatever, and he was hammered. Well, he would get hammered by TMZ for being hammered at a house party. But if somebody Jewish was hammered, no one gives a holy grunt. So you guys get away with so much more stuff.
Slow down. If that was Steve Leader, I'd get pasted. I'd get slammed.
Yeah. Well, that's because you're one of the top dudes. Like, I just mean a regular schmuck.
But he's not.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
Right. So what I'm saying is clergy are symbolic exemplars, and people bring their ideas to them, and if they can't be moral, they want their clergy to be moral. So I think clergy are in a different, you know, completely different category.
Okay.
And by the way, that's one of the things that makes it difficult to be clergy.
Yeah, I'm not signing up for that one.
That's why I live in a cave.
Okay, just before we say goodbye to you and let you have your life back again, I've been looking at Mubi and going, dude, you got something you want to throw down at Steve? What do you got?
Well, first, I also have a daughter named Hannah, so right on.
Oh, okay. Hi, you guys are pals now. Whatever.
We're brothers.
Yeah. No, it's actually a lot of what you said applies to the Muslim community as well, right? I mean, you have
for sure
like Wahhabi, really Saudi Wahhabi influences, you know, since the 70s, really. The exportation of Wahhabi Islam through petrodollars has brought, you know, this rigid, unbending way of looking at the world into the collective Muslim psyche. And they're horrified that there be any kind of liberalism, again, religiously, not politically. And they're horrified at that. And yet, when you look at the traditions, they're actually quite liberal. And I love that point about brothers and sisters, let us pray. I mean, it's very similar in the Muslim psyche, where we reject a lot of what is quote-unquote Western, when in fact, quite a bit, a lot of what is Western, quote-unquote, is actually Judeo-Islamic. Right? Judeo-Christian, forget that term. It's a complete fake term. It really is. Because, I mean, Christianity was hostile to Judaism for the longest time, and it was actually Muslims and Christians that were, you know, totally cool with each other. I always use the story of when I talk to extremists, actually, I've used this example on them, and I'm like, what do you say of a Muslim general who has as one of his closest confidants a Jew, not just any Jew, a rabbi? And they're like, unequivocally, 100% of the time, they always say, no, he's compromised, you can't do that, da-da-da. I was like, great, because I'm talking about Salah ad-Din and Maimonides, one of the greatest rabbis in the Jewish faith.
Yeah.
You know, so
who wrote in Arabic.
And that's where my Sufi bias comes into play, because Sufism and Judaism actually have a lot of links because of that or cross-pollination. So a lot of the things you're saying applies equally well to the Muslim community.
Yeah. And look, Drew, there's no question he's right. And there is much more that unites us and divides us. So I want to say one word about this book that I have out now called More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms.
Yes, great book.
Part of the reason the book is seeing the success that it is because it is speaking to all three religious communities. All of us deal with theodicy, with the problem of God and suffering, and what does it all mean? And the book pulls together views from Islam, Judaism, and Christianity about how is it possible to be a person of faith and yet endure suffering and endure loss? And how is it possible for every one of us who walks through hell, and we all walk through hell at some point, to come out, you know, with a more meaningful experience and not to come out of hell empty-handed? And, you know, one of the nicest emails I got about that book was about 4 or 5 weeks ago. My friend Rick Warren sent me an email. He said, I just want you to know, a friend of mine told me that More Beautiful Than Before is the best writing on faith and suffering he has ever seen. And this is coming from an evangelical Christian to a rabbi. So I think I'm obviously pushing this book, but I'm pushing it something else, which is that we all have to recognize that there's a great common denominator to the human experience, and that is the search for meaning in the midst of our struggles. And that is where Judaism, Islam, and Christianity all have so much to say, and let's not be distracted by the nonsense of extremism on the edges of all three of those faiths.
Yeah, well said. Rick and Kay Warren will be on our show before the end of the month.
He's a good man. Say hi for me.
Yeah, he's not a knob.
No, he's a great guy.
Yeah, it's so, and that's why I want these guys back. There's so many. I'm just not a big fan of many in that crowd, but I like those guys. Okay, listen, Rabbi Steve Leder, thank you very, very, very much. The website is steveleder.com. That's L-E-D-E-R, L-E-D-E-R, Rabbi Steve Leder, steveleder.com. You need to get the book that he just talked about, but you also need to be hanging tight for the next one that is going to drop. When's it dropping, though, man?
It'll be in the spring of 2021. It's going to be called The Beauty of What Remains, What Death Teaches Us About Life.
Love it. Thank you, Steve. Thank
good
you.
Good luck to you, Drew.
Thank you.
You're a remarkable guy.
Oh, stop.
This is true.
Stop it.
It's true.
All right.
It's true.
All right.
All right, my friend.
Look forward to seeing your face one of these days.
Thank you, Sam. Right.
Thanks, bye-bye. Steve.
Rabbi Shalom. Steve Leader and the Drew Marshall Show. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf will be joining us. He is the West's most influential Islamic scholar, so says the Muslim 500. By the way, what's the Muslim 500? Is that like the New York Post of you guys?
No, it's a race.
It's a race, yeah. It's fastest drivers in Egypt. They go across Egypt, Somalia, and Yemen and see if they can get through the traffic.
Wow. That's hilarious. That's it. No, listen, Sheikh Yusuf was on our show before, and
he's legend,
that was
man.
Your reference, he's or legend. That was your referral. You said, get this guy. Oh, got him. Yeah. Phenomenal. But he played a role in you becoming less of a jerk.
Yeah.
True story?
Yeah.
You've never spoken before?
No.
How are you feeling about this?
I might be a little nervous.
Really?
Possibly. We'll see.
Just keep that trigger
he's,
in your...
He's legend.
Hidden there. Sheikh Hamza Yusuf on the Drew Marshall Show, coming up next. Stay with us.